This morning we are delighted to present to you our own Dean DeYoung of the College of Fine Arts. Dean DeYoung is an author, composer of excellent music. He has been and is an international-minded individual, with great travel experience back of him. And generally, I don't know of any individual who has a greater love for the beautiful and who has done more to create that for our own school and for our own community than has Dean DeYoung. We're very happy this morning to have him talk to you and to present to you some of the interesting and thrilling things out of his own thinking, titled as he chooses to do that. Dean DeYoung.
I'm very grateful for the opportunity of addressing you this summer. I'm afraid that unlike the Partridge last Tuesday, I'm going to use all the old jokes over again. I see many of you coming back summer after summer and winter after winter, and we just have too much work to do around here in order to cook up something new every time. So I am going to draw very freely on the jokes that went over before. Today, in all seriousness, I'd like to talk to you about art and culture as it might find its place in our everyday life. I'm not going to talk to you about the long-haired variety, the bohemian kind, but I'm talking about art and culture as it finds its place in our everyday life. Now, in other words, not some other time. There's nothing new about the idea that art and culture should be part of our lives. The Savior himself told us that we should live the abundant life. We should not be content with a flat, dull existence, but we should live the abundant life. I know that there are a great many people who think that that referred to the hereafter. It does not. The abundant life refers to now and here, and the Savior meant it that way. He wanted our lives to be rich and full, and not to be reduced to simply one of our many interests in life. Evidently, his statement that man should not live by bread alone plainly indicated that he did not think that the material aspects of life were enough to satisfy us. We should also be concerned about the spiritual values of our lives. And I do not mean again by spiritual values the purely religious aspects, but I mean by the spiritual values, all those values and interests and activities that you and I are engage in, outside of those that are calculated to extend our existence here. In other words, many of us spend so much time thinking about making a living that there's no time left over to live. And that is a bad situation. I think that that would be, in the fullest sense of the word, living by bread alone. We should fill our lives full of spiritual values, or as Professor Larson sometimes calls them, the plus values. The values that are not particularly necessary in order to keep on living, but which are necessary to make our life worthwhile. It was Mohammed who was supposed to have said that if you find yourselves with a loaf of bread in each hand, you should exchange the loaf in one hand for some flowers of the narcissus. Now, I don't know whether you like narcissus or not, but the idea is very plain that not only the material aspects of life, not only simply continuing to live, is important, but beauty in life too must be considered and must be in life in order to make life worthwhile. Art and culture are very often considered as extra things in life, tacked on, so to speak, separate and apart from life. I don't think they should be. A great many people think of art, for instance, as painting of pictures, composing music, taking a part in a play, or reciting poetry, or things of that type. That alone is not art. I had been preaching for 25 years a different theory than that when I discovered all at once that Elbert Hubbard had said exactly the same thing. Art is simply the best way of doing anything that you do. Art is simply the better way of doing the things that you do. Which means that all of you, all of us, can be artists, even though we may not have particular capacity for painting pictures or composing music or reciting poetry. We can show a certain amount of excellence in all the things that we do. It has been said before that all that is worth doing well. That is art. And you are not in competition with anybody when you do that, except with yourself. In other words, you and I should never be satisfied with our performance today if it doesn't surpass our performance yesterday, in whatever we do. We should never be satisfied simply to have arrived at a certain point and then say, that's good enough from now on. Reminds me a little of the question I asked of one man once about capital punishment. I said, what do you think of capital punishment? Well, he said, it was good enough for my father, it was good enough for my grandfather, it's good enough for me. And probably it was literally true. I remember also that when a certain missionary by the name of Anderson over in England met Brother Lyman, who was then in charge of the mission, Brother Francis M. Lyman, great missionary. He said, what did you say your name was? He said, Anderson. And they exchanged some more information. He said, oh, I knew your dad. And he slapped the boy on the back. He says, I hope you're a better man than your dad. The boy worried very much about that statement. And after the meeting, he said, Brother Lyman, what's the matter with my dad? He said, nothing that I know of. Well, then why do you say you hoped I was a better man than my dad? Well, he said, we ought to get ahead a little bit every generation. We ought not to... ought not to just stay where we are. We ought to make a little progress right along. Well, now that applies to each of us as individuals too. We may have arrived at a certain point of excellence in our performance, whatever we're engaged in, but if we want to be artists, we should not leave it at that. We should go on from there, and day by day, month by month, year by year, surpass our own performance and become better all the time. That's beginning to sound like my French friend Coué now, doesn't it? Culture, too, is very often thought of as frills, things that you tack on like a lace collar or something of that sort. That isn't the nature of culture. I think that a real meaning of culture would be the complete comprehension of life, to know what it's all about. And to penetrate it, to get down to the bottom of things, and not keep on floating on the surface all the time, or to be content with just one or two or ten little phases of life, in place of wanting life whole. As a matter of fact, that was Matthew Arnold's definition. Culture to him meant to see life whole. Not to see it just in part, but to see it whole. In our present day, idea for specialization that we have, we are very likely to overlook the value of seeing life whole. And we're likely to get the idea that we are designated to be interested only in one little phase of our existence and not see life whole. I remember standing behind a man in a Ford factory in Detroit once upon a time. I watched him work for a while. And finally I said to him, just what are you? He said, I'm a mechanician. I said, what's that? Well, he said, for instance, I have a Ford car passing by me at a very slow rate on an eternal belt, slowly, and I reach in and I tighten bolt number 237. I check, see that it's good and tight, and by that time the Ford car has passed a few feet away from me and another one takes its place, and I reach in, same wrench, and tighten bolt number 237. I said, that's all you have to do is tighten bolt number 237? Yes, that's all I have to do. But if I didn't do it, he said, something would go radically wrong with that car. And I said, and you call that being a mechanician? Yes, that's a mechanician. Well, I could just imagine that fellow out with his family on a Sunday afternoon in his Ford car. Then the car would break down and he would sit there and he wouldn't know a thing about it. He wouldn't know what to do. Unless, of course, it was Bolt 237. He would have that down cold. Well, now I submit that that's very good for us who drive Ford cars, to have somebody check Bolt 237 and all the other bolts. But I don't think that the type of work that that man was engaged in, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, was particularly designed to make his life full and rich. No wonder the Ford companies and other great industrial concerns have to have gymnasiums and play gardens and swimming pools and concert halls for their employees. I should think they'd go nuts if they didn't have them. That's an unintended pun. Now, a great many people will agree with me at once when I say we should have a certain amount of art and culture in our life. And then when I turn around and say, well, what do you mean by the cultural and by art in life and all that sort of thing? And I find that they are very much concerned about what we have learned to call the practical side of life. And I find also that our theory of education, our philosophy of education, is shot through, first of all, with that idea that we must not waste time teaching people non-essentials. We must teach them only those things which are practical. And then when I pin my friends down for a definition of what they mean by practical, I find that they mean by that very largely the vocational. Anything that is calculated directly and observably to contribute to the making of a living, they would call practical. And outside of that, they wouldn't see very great practical value in anything. And so a great many subjects that once upon a time had a respectable status in our curriculum now go begging because we cannot see how these particular subjects can directly contribute to the making of a living. Buying ham sandwiches, in other words. Well, now, you say, well, what is there of more importance than that? Well, there may not be anything of more importance than that, than to be able to make a living. But I'm saying, what do you do the other 8 hours of the day? Roughly speaking, you spend about 8 hours out of the 24 sleeping, you spend about 8 hours out of the 24 working to make a living, and then you have 8 hours on your hands, literally. Literally. Unless you are directed and dictated to what to do with those 8 hours by the considerations of making a living, you stand and look around and you're lost. You don't know what to do. Isn't that literally true? It's in those 8 hours of the day that we actually live. You never read about a people in the pages of history who distinguished themselves because they took care of the necessities of life. Because they worked long enough and hard enough in order to have food for everybody, in order to have shelter, a place to live in order to have clothes to wear. You never saw anybody's life recorded in the pages of history because they did those things. But the people you read about in history are those who knew what to do with the other 8 hours of the day and who made them count culturally. And so the assignment is still with us. We must learn how to use our so-called leisure time. We must know what to do with these other 8 hours. So that to me, anything that will help people not only to make a living 8 hours a day, but also to live the other 8 hours a day is practical and should be included in the curriculum of our public schools. In other words, the teachers who teach in the public schools have a greater responsibility than simply to teach arithmetic, history, chemistry, French, shop work, and things of that type. They also have a responsibility to revive and to cultivate in the very souls of their students a desire for these fine contributions that they can make. If they learn what to do in these other 8 hours of the day. I have a friend who happens to be a farmer. His lot might be shared by a lot of other people who make a living in a different way. He gets up in the morning. At least he calls it morning. I'd call it the middle of the night. About 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. He is, of course, dead to the world when he wakes up. His wife has already been up half an hour before that to cook a breakfast, good substantial breakfast, ham and eggs and stack of wheats and I don't know what all. And she's been slaving over her hot kitchen stove for 20 minutes or more to cook his breakfast. Well, he sits down, he eats his breakfast. And he drags himself up from the table and he goes out and works on the farm. If he goes any distance from the house, his wife also prepares a lunch for him, cold things in a dinner bucket. During the day, sometime he sits down and spends 20 minutes eating that. He comes home at night toward dark, dead tired, of course, and he sits down again to the table and eats a supper that his wife has prepared. Then when that's about over, he reaches out for the evening paper and he looks over the headlines. He reads one or two articles that seem to be of particular interest to him. Before he gets to the fifth page, he's sound asleep. By that time, his wife nudges him, and he moves from the table to the overstuffed chair in the front room. He picks up a magazine, something heavy to read, Life. Then he looks at a few of the pictures in that. About 9 o'clock, his wife wakes him up again and said, John, if you're just going to sit there and sleep, you might as well go to bed. So John goes to bed. Then the next morning, about 4:30 or 5, he gets up again. Only this time he's more tired than he was the day before. And he goes through the same rigmarole again, day after day. And when Sunday comes, because it threatens to rain, he can't get his hay in, so he can't go to church either. He can't pass up the chance to get his hay in, so he can't go to church. And so he goes on 7 days a week. You call that living? Yeah, but he says, I'm making a lot of money, paying pretty good income tax. You call that living? Is that what he was placed upon this earth for? It seems to me that there's something radically lacking in his life. And certainly, that kind of happiness is not to be envied. Any cow in the meadow does that well. It chews its cud and its grass until it is fed properly. It looks for a little shade at noon behind the barn or behind a clump of trees. And it wishes no more. As long as my friend comes around and relieves the cow of the milk a couple of times a day, it's perfectly happy. The kind of happiness that I call bovine happiness. But is that kind of bovine happiness the kind that you want? Is that the kind of existence that will satisfy you? Could we call that an abundant life? Could we call that full and rich and interesting? Of course not. Anything that contributes to the fullness of life, even though not strictly vocational, even though it does not have anything directly to do with our trade or profession, is practical. In that we stand in need of it in order to fill out our life with things that are worthwhile. We do not want merely to keep alive. We want to live abundantly. And we should prepare to spend profitably, not only the time spent in making a living, but also the time spent when the day's work is done. The vocational and the so-called cultural together, that is life. Either one alone is only part of life. Now, what is it you want to get interested in then? What shall you be interested in? Consequently, what shall we teach in the schools too? Because unless you arouse an interest in certain things in the public schools, these people will not get interested in these things when they get out of school. You must start with your pupils early to interest them in things that may not seem too practical for the time being. If you don't do it, it'll be too late. Their habits will be formed, Their pattern of life will have been established by the time they get out of high school, and they'll go right through life as my farmer friend John does. Shall we study history? Well, a lot of people say, history? Why do I bother about what people used to do hundreds of years ago? What can I learn out of that? What does that have to do with me? Well, to me, the study of history is one way to make a lot of worthwhile acquaintances. And certainly, that's one thing I want out of life. A lot of worthwhile acquaintances. They may not all live at the same time as I do, but still I want to know about them, and I want to be acquainted with them. I don't want just dates either when somebody teaches me history. A lot of teachers, maybe not you, but a lot of teachers in the schools thought that when they taught history, they simply tried to crowd a lot of dates down the throats of their students, so that whenever you gave them an examination, they could be properly regurgitated. But I think that's not the proper way to look at history. I had a friend once who was a history teacher. He taught nothing but history. This happened to be over in Europe, and in that country, they had a different system from ours. The tenure of office as a teacher was directly dependent upon the reports sent in by the inspectors, who come around about 3-4 times a year. And this boy, who had had all the training prescribed for a history teacher in his country, got the idea that the inspector was soon coming around. So he pumped his class full of information about the history that he was studying, so that no matter what question the inspector would ask, they would be able to fire back at him without a moment's notice. So, sure enough, the inspector came in one day in the next week, regular sourpuss, sat down in a corner, and the history teacher said, "Sir, would you like to take the class this morning?" That's the courtesy invitation that always comes, especially when the teacher himself feels rather shaky. At least I know that I always get that invitation to take over the class whenever, as a general board member of Sunday school, I visit a Sunday school class. They always invite me to take the class. But I never tumble. I never take it. Anyway, the inspector, too, was on to the gag. And he said, "No, you go right ahead. I want to watch your work." So he went ahead and he asked what happened in this date, on that date, on the other date. And as fast as he got a date out, somebody raised his hand. Pretty soon more people raised their hands. And the inspector was impressed with the idea that everybody knew everything in this class, because he had prepared them thoroughly. And so he asked him lots of dates. And the rate kept going faster and faster and faster. And finally he said, "When was Charlemagne crowned emperor of the Holy Roman Empire?" And everybody, without waiting even, thundered out, 800. And then the inspector got up and said, "A.D. or B.C.?" Nobody knew. Well, that's only a difference of 1,600 years. What's that among friends? Now, what was the matter with history teaching? They knew plenty of dates. They had more dates than a GI gets nowadays. What was wrong with it? They were not developing any type of feeling for history. They were not really making worthwhile acquaintances through their study of history. They were not getting the feel of things. Now, surely, you analyze the question, those of you who also missed it this morning. When was Charlemagne crowned emperor of the Holy Roman Empire? Which Voltaire said was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. When could that happen? Before or after the birth of Christ? What was the most important thing that Charlemagne ever did? To convert Western Europe to Christianity. And when they didn't come along peacefully, he always had his sword to help him. Now, surely they must have gotten that out of their study of Charlemagne. If they didn't get that, what did they get out of Charlemagne? And that's what I mean by getting the feel of things. Even if they had never thought of the question, they could have figured it out on a moment's notice. And so I say, it's a good thing to study history, provided you study history and not just dates. Would you study literature? Well, a lot of people don't seem to have any time for it. What kind of literature? Biography? Yes, biography. That's just like history. That deals with real people. Many people would say, oh yes, I'd love to spend some time at that. Biography. That's where you get real people, same as in history. Besides that, you get a certain amount of style, literary style, certain amount of art, certain amount of form. That's very pleasing. So biography is all right. Well, what about poetry? Poetry? Too artificial for most people. They just don't get it. Why should anybody read or listen to poetry? Well, the poet expresses the feelings that we feel but cannot express. In other words, the poet is probably much more sensitive to things about us than we are. And so, since he can observe better, and since he can express what he sees better than we can, he helps us make a partial expression, at any rate, of the things that we feel. And it expands our feelings. It makes us bigger inside. And so there's a certain amount of value in reading poetry and becoming acquainted with that, good poetry. Fiction? Oh, no, somebody says. Why, that fellow spends time reading novels. Imagine, they'll say. Who'd want to spend time reading novels? There's some of you right here in this congregation who said that thing. What nonsense to read novels. Well, those people are not real. They're all made up by somebody's mind, purely imagined. There's nothing in there you can learn. Well, I wonder if there isn't. Any of you ever read any Charles Dickens? David Copperfield, perhaps? Of course, all of you have read that, haven't you? David Copperfield. Does that deal with real people? What difference does it make? What difference does it make whether these people that he described in David Copperfield actually lived or not? I think that there were prototypes for most of his characters in David Copperfield. But that's beside the point. I remember one character in there, Uriah Heep. If you've ever read David Copperfield, I just need to mention the name, and immediately you have a sensation that is just about as real as any you ever have. I learned to hate hypocrisy by becoming acquainted with Uriah Heep more thoroughly than by being acquainted with any living person. Every time you mention the name Uriah Heep to me, I can see him again, standing by a fire, more or less bent over like this, like a big question mark, offering to put out his clammy hand to shake it, to show how humble he is, and all that. And every time I think of that, I ball up my fist and I want to smash him one. Why? Because he was 103% hypocrite. He was just about as bad as he could get when it came to sincerity and genuineness. And I learned to hate hypocrisy more through becoming acquainted with Uriah Heep than anybody who lived next door neighbor to me, or anybody else for that matter. Is that real? Is Uriah Heep real to me? I think we should spend some time reading fiction. Good fiction. I don't mean true stories or things of that type. But real fiction. Real good fiction. That is worth our time. Would you study English? Oh, how freshmen squirm when they discover that they have to have freshman English. One of my colleagues on the faculty here helped a freshman girl, register once upon a time. And he put down, after her course in religion, a course in English. He said, "Why do I have to study some more English?" He said, well, rather apologetically, it's customary here for the freshman to take a course in freshman English. Well, she says, I ain't ever studied much of it, but I speak as good as them what has. Now, why do you laugh? Have you ever analyzed that? Why do you laugh? What's funny about that? What's English for? What is language for? I just need to ask that question. Everybody glibly gives me the answer. Language is to communicate ideas. Well, do you think my colleague was in the dark about what she meant? She couldn't have put it any more clearly than that. The content of her message went over 100%. Then why do you laugh? You're proving the point that I'm trying to make today. that in speaking too, in talking, the thing that you and I do so much of all the time, in talking too, we expect more than content. We expect form. And those are the two essential elements of any art, content and form. When you speak, you must have something to say, but you must also know how to say it. So you and I expect not only to receive a message, an idea, when somebody speaks to us, but we expect a certain amount of art. We expect a certain amount of beauty. We expect a certain amount of refined skill in putting over this idea. And that's why we study language. It isn't just to satisfy certain arbitrary demands or requirements for graduation or something of that sort. It's to help us, it's to equip us with those things that we need in order to go through life, and so that our life might be full and might be beautiful and might be rich. What about art in the sense of painting and so on? Should that find a place in our life? I remember a story that Professor Larson very often told, which I must repeat here. An artist jumped into his Jeep and took his paraphernalia with him, drove out away from a busy town up into the hills for about an hour, and then set up his easel and went to work. After a while, one of the elite 400 came along and stood and looked at him through her lorgnette, on the end of a stick, you know, like that. And she turned around to look at the hills that served as the subject for what the artist was painting. And finally, she felt it necessary to rebuke the artist by saying, I don't see all those colors in those drab old hills. What would you have done if you'd been the artist? Well, he was wise. He turned around, and with a note of pity in his voice, he said, don't you wish you could? In this simple story lies a great lesson for us again. Was this artist actually seeing those colors in those drab old hills? He was. Well, then how was it that this lady couldn't see them? She didn't have the same type of trained eye that the artist had. Like the poet, and like the prophet, the artist develops a greater sensitivity. And he develops along with it a skill to express what he sees and what he feels and what he hears. And so all of us must try to sharpen our eye, to sharpen our sight, to deepen our insight, and to see more, and to hear more, and to feel more deeply. Then we'll have something to live by. And occasionally, some of us may even develop some skill in expressing these feelings. I think there is a place for professional artists in every community, just as there is a place for professional medical men and professional legal men, lawyers, professional engineers, professional teachers, and so on. What would be the function of the artist? To reveal the beauties about us, which are now a closed book to most people, to show those and to bring them out. I well remember how President Brimhall, who used to be the president here, used to say, you have never seen Timpanogos in all its glories until you have seen about a dozen paintings by different painters expressing what they saw in Timpanogos. And every morning now when I step out of my back door, since that day, many years ago, I look up at Timpanogos and I see a different Timpanogos every day. Not just a pile of dirt out there, 12,008 feet high, but different beauties, a different composition, a different expression of a different beauty every day again. It is literally true. Some of us look, but we see not. Not until we are trained, not until we are helped, not until these things are pointed out to us, sometimes do we see the beauties that surround us so copiously. Music, do you need that to live a full life, a rich life? What good were these musical numbers we heard here this morning? You won't get a better grade in geography because of those. But what a glorious thing to be able to take 5 minutes and to listen to those pieces. What a glorious thing. The kind of thrill that you got out of listening to those pieces was quite different, I admit, from worrying about your geography or your French or whatever you're studying right now. But they helped to make your life fuller and richer and more beautiful. I remember coming down Main Street in Salt Lake City once upon a time, and just below First South was a music store, that is, a store where they sold radios and turntables, Victrolas and so on. And they were playing a record in order to attract attention. And as soon as I heard it, I thought, Caruso. Glorious voice. To some people, the most glorious voice we've ever had in any one human being. And I stepped to the edge of the sidewalk so that I could stay there and be out of the way from the traffic and still hear. And I listened to every note of it and enjoyed every note of it. Along came a man in working clothes, evidently in a hurry. He stopped stock still all at once when he heard the music, looked around at me and others standing there listening, shrugged his shoulders and said, "Man in a fit," walked on. Now, the sad part of it is that that's exactly what it was, a man in a fit, as far as that man was concerned. And that's all he ever will see in it until somebody opens his eyes or opens his ears and points out the beauties in that type of performance. That man is going through life and he isn't getting a bit of good out of all the music that he hears. Not a bit of good. But somebody sometime will help him and will show him. He's not like you, you see, getting a chance day after day to be exposed to fine things. And that's the thing that counts. What you're not up on, you're down on. And he wasn't up on music, and that's why he was down on it, you see. He needs to be exposed, and he needs to be told time after time what he's listening to. And then he will see what it's all about. And he, too, will get enjoyment and pleasure. And he, too, will see beauty. What about religion? Should that be included in the subject matter that our students study? Well, that immediately brings up a lot of questions. You say, well, I haven't any right as a teacher in a public school to drag in religion. Well, I don't see how you can avoid it. What is religion? I don't want you to confuse religion now with theology, because that's a different thing. By theology, I mean the science that deals with our relationships to God. There are lots of theologians who are not religious at all. They know the Bible forward and backward, but they don't live in such a way as to reflect the teachings of the Bible. I know a great many so-called Mormons who know all about the Book of Mormon. They can recite you almost any passage in it, but they're not religious. Because they don't live their religion. They don't live their theology. Religion is not a science like theology. Religion is an art. And by art here, I mean it's what we do about these things, not just what we say about them or what we think we know about them, but what we do about them every day. It's our behavior pattern that speaks for itself. Oh, I admit that you can't very well be thoroughly religious without having some theological background or basis for your religion. You have to have a certain amount of theory before you can put the theory into practice. But a lot of people are not very conscious of their theoretical background and still live a thoroughly religious life. I'm afraid, again, that a great many people who are assigned to teach religion confuse the issue and think that they are supposed to tell them Bible stories and to have their students memorize passages out of the scriptures and so on and think they're doing a very good job teaching religion. I remember one man in Salt Lake once upon a time who was known all over this country as a great religion teacher. And once upon a time he gave a demonstration. And he would sit in the back of the room, and his students, a dozen of them, would sit on the platform, and he would say, where do you find this passage? In the beginning the Word was, and the Word was God, and so on. Somebody would say, John, first chapter, first verse. Where do you find the Lord's Prayer? And they would give you Matthew, so-and-so. And he would just keep it up, you know, faster than I can tell you about it. And everybody would just be dazed with the capacity of those students to cite chapter and verse. I remember he said to one time, what's the content of chapter 35, Matthew? Somebody said, there are no 35 chapters in Matthew. They knew that right off, you see, right off. And this man thought he was teaching religion. Now, I'm not saying what he taught them wasn't very good. It was very good, as far as it went. But the teaching of religion isn't concluded at that point. That's where the teaching of religion begins, not ends. To help to put these students to put into practice every day what they read in these scriptures. That's the important thing in religion. Last Tuesday we heard about being fundamentally honest, sincere, genuine. Is that religion? Of course it's religion. Of course it's religion. Whether the Savior spoke about it or not. And you as teachers, most of you, have the responsibility of inculcating into your students the desire, the determination to live the principles of righteousness and religion. Unless you do that, you are not making cultured people out of your students. They may know all the science there is to know and all the mathematics and all the languages and so on. If they do not show in their behavior pattern, in their everyday behavior pattern, the way they live, these rich qualities that come from knowing what religion and theology teaches us and putting those into our lives, they're still not cultured. They still don't enjoy any culture. I don't care how great a scientist. If he has no religion, he's not a cultured person. I don't care how great the religionist. If he has no science, knows nothing of the learning of man, he's not cultured. He's not cultured. It takes both sides of our existence, development in both fields, before we can lay claim to culture. And I say it is necessary for us to develop culture, to develop a richness of life. We must not go through life as a flat, dull, unsavory existence. It must be full of beauty before we can enjoy it. Let's push out our horizons. Let's include more and more into our life, not less and less, as our present-day specialization would dictate to us. Let's include more and more into our lives, and let's make our lives richer constantly. I pray that the Lord will help us to see the values where values lie and not be fooled by simply worshiping certain tags, certain nameplates, certain designations, just because certain things are designated science or religion or art or culture. A great many people worship these things, but they don't get down in and say, what do these things mean in my life? Not just in word of mouth, but in my life, in my everyday behavior pattern. I pray that we may always be awake to seeing the many beauties that are constantly about us in our life. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.